listener production. Vex King is a mindset coach, writer, and lifestyle entrepreneur. His wisdom lies in being authentic, having lived through so much pain and healed to rise on the other side. He is most known for his best-selling books and motivational writing on social media that has amassed a following of millions. In this powerful conversation, we discuss his childhood, living in severe poverty and violence to creating a life of abundance, the importance of hope, and why change can be hard, but it's always worth it.
There's three people here who are amongst the wealthiest people in the world who have subjectively had worse childhoods than me, but have yet created amazing lives for themselves. If they can do it, why can I not do it? And that question really changed everything for me. The only thing that got them from point A to B was their mindset. And that's when I realized that I needed to change the way I looked at my life. I needed to change the way I respond to life. I needed to change the fact that I think I'm a victim here.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behaviour, personal growth and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. Vex King is the author of the best-selling books Good Vibes, Good Life, Healing is the New High, and his newest book, Closer to Love. I want to preface this conversation by saying it's one of the most inspirational stories I have ever heard. Vex is incredible and his wisdom is profound. It's easy to understand and then put into your everyday. My hope is that this conversation allows you to realise that change is possible for everyone if that's what you want. All you need to do is take the first step, then the next, then the next. Vex King, I want to start by talking a bit about your background because you've had a very colourful life and things didn't start out so easy for you. So I'd like you to start by talking to us a bit about that.
I like that way you described it as a colourful life. It's probably the best way to put it. So 6 months after I was born, my dad died. So my mom was raising me and my two sisters who are older than me. We've got a 2-year age gap between us. And for 3 years of my childhood, we were often homeless. So we weren't technically on the streets, but we didn't have a home. So we were moving around to different housing shelters, hotels, living with family if we were welcome in their homes. And life was just one big struggle. And then eventually when my mum actually got her own house, or our own house that we call our home, we weren't quite welcome there. I'm of Indian heritage and unfortunately our neighbours weren't too welcoming of our race. In fact, a lot of people in our area weren't too welcoming of our race and we were often told to go home back to our own country. When we first got our home, it felt like this massive win. It was like, finally, we've got something to call ours. Just from moving in after day one, there was this deep feeling of rejection that you're not wanted here, that this doesn't belong to you, you should leave. And the years that followed were a massive struggle. So we experienced severe poverty where my mum often struggled not just to pay the bills, but to put food on the table. Then we witnessed all sorts of violence. The racism continued. And as life got harder, I remember just looking out the window one day, looking around me and thinking, life shouldn't be this hard. Life shouldn't be this sad or depressing. I need to find a way out. And I suppose from that point, I was on this conquest to try and find a better way of life. Even before we found the house, there was a point where I lived with my uncle. And my uncle had a news agent, so like a grocery grocery store, and he lived above it. So it was him, so my uncle and his family, so my two cousins as well. And then it was me, my mum and two sisters. And I must have only been around like 5 or 6 years old. I remember one day my mum like rushing down the stairs to the shop floor, and I didn't know what was going on. And I just hear screaming and shouting. So my curiosity as a child, you know, and, you know, I'm not saying I remember this crystal clear memory. It's almost like a blur because I was so young. But I remember going to the top of the stairs and looking down onto the shop floor, and I can see thieves, masked thieves. A few of them were pulling my mum's hair, my auntie's hair, my sister's, who would have been, so my eldest would have been 9 years old at the time. And then I see a gun to my uncle's face and his nose full of blood. And I just remember this fear, but this adrenaline just running through my body. I was angry, but I felt powerless. And then I remember my mum seeing me and her quickly breaking away, looking at me and saying to me, "Stay there, don't come down." And at that point I thought, wow, I literally have no control over this situation. And I'm seeing my mum and my uncle abused, my auntie, my two sisters abused, him being held at gunpoint, and there's nothing I can really do. I'm scared. I want to help, but I also want to obey my mum's orders to stay here. And also, even if I do go down, you know, will I end up hurt? And that created this kind of, I'll say, subtle form of trauma. Every time I went out into the world, even if it wasn't unsafe and unsettling, I felt like there were threats around me. Now, when we went over to our new home, that trauma was only heightened. I wasn't offered much safety. Soon as I stepped outside of my house, I had to fight my way to even just be accepted in that area. I would get angry at kids telling me that I didn't belong there. They would come and take my ball, and then I'd chase them around, and I'd try not to hurt them. And I say I try not to hurt them, because what would usually happen would be that they'd take my ball. And my mum always told me to, you know, treat people with kindness, but also to stick up for myself to some extent. Otherwise, people were just going to trample on me throughout life. But, you know, there'd eventually be about 10 kids with my ball taking, you know, picking on me. And I'd just end up, you know, I'd end up fighting them. And there'd be times where they'd be all on top of me. But because I was so angry and had this willpower that naturally emerged, that I won't let people win and let them take control of my life, that I would end up hurting them. And then they would go home, tell their parents, and their parents would come knocking on my mum's door saying, "Your child has hurt our kids." And the reality of it was that it was them almost bullying me, taking my ball, not letting me enjoy peace of mind and freedom. And I was retaliating. So that anger was really my defense against the pain that I was feeling. But all those situations, plus I had kidnappers around in my local area.
Oh my God.
My school was only a short walk, but I had kidnappers around in that area as well. And there was just a lot of unsettling and lack of safety around, which then just heightened the feeling of not being safe at all in this world. And that view, when I looked out the window and I looked around and I said to myself, I needed to, you know, change things around. That was this almost cry for help as well at the same time. It was me saying to myself that there must be something better out there for me in this world. You know, life can't always be like this. And even when I made friends that lived in the same area, and I talk about these dreams of, you know, breaking away, maybe having a slightly bigger house, maybe not having to face these challenges, they couldn't quite understand it, because all me and my family and the other families that lived around us, all we were used to was suffering and turmoil. So a better way of life was outside the norm. They didn't quite understand how that would happen, and I didn't quite like their response to this dream that I had. So during my teenage years, I turned to the internet, and I was a massive, well, I still am, but, you know, I was a big hip hop fan, and I used to go on this hip hop forum. So it's like a message board almost. And people would talk about that new music that was coming up, and movies and all kinds of stuff. But I was all intrigued by philosophy, spirituality, neuroscience, and all of that kind of stuff. And there was this sub forum where you'd talk about those things. And I remember people talking about books, books that had changed their lives or other celebrities' lives and public figures. And I was also a big martial arts fan. So there was a book that people were saying that changed Bruce Lee's life. And I was like, wow, I'm a major Bruce Lee fan. If it, you know, if it changes life, it might change my life. And it was a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And that started this journey into personal development. I didn't have resources. I didn't have people to lean on. I didn't have mentors. You know, I didn't have the option for therapy. And I suppose therapy back then wasn't really normalized either. I didn't have the privilege of certain resources. All I could turn to was the internet. And on the internet, I could turn to other people who were kind of experiencing similar dilemmas as me all across the world. Like there were people from America, from Canada, Australia, you know, all parts of the world. And we were talking about our struggles, but we were also trying to help each other out. And this book, I suppose, was my pathway towards a better life. So the following years after, things did change because what I realized, and as cliche as this phrase sounds to most people, is that a positive mind will give you a positive life. I think rationally we can understand that. If the lens that you're viewing life through seems glamorous or seems optimistic, then you're going to deem the circumstances ahead of you as favorable. But of course, that's harder to practice. It's so much easier said than done, as with everything else. And I suppose I went on this journey of personal development to really lead back to myself, because as life improved, what I realized was that not every moment was full of comfort or joy. And there were a lot of times where I was triggered by things, but for the sake of trying to be positive or happy, I was suppressing how I felt. And I suppose when we look at generalizations with gender, men are great at this generally. You know, we like to suppress. We don't like to face our demons because it's uncomfortable. And we're told to just kind of, you know, brush things off and continue chasing this lifestyle, meeting these expectations that are set by society. And when I got to my early 20s, you know, I kind of lost the will to live. Things really changed for me. Everything in life seemed to be going downhill. And there was this one particular moment where I felt like I was burdening the world by just existing. And in that moment, when you're in this kind of negative state, you can very easily fall down this negative spiral. And I looked back on my life and I looked back on all those moments that I lived through. And I just deemed my life as being this really depressing, sad story that has no hope. There's no chance of me having this happy ending. Nothing's ever going to work out for me. Look back, and you know, this was some of the narrative that was going on in my mind, is look back on your life, like nothing great ever happens. Like everything always ends up bad. You know, people always end up hurting you, or worse off, you hurt other people. And, you know, I lost my will to live, and I won't go into graphic detail, but I overcame that moment. And as I overcame that moment and that period, I said to myself, I can never, ever return to this moment again, because you literally nearly gave up on everything and you fought so hard to be here. And, you know, there was these thoughts that I was having of my single mum, and, you know, my single mother, she's worked tirelessly to raise us kids. Like, I don't know anyone that's worked as hard as her just to put food on the table. And she sacrificed so much for me and my sisters. And I'm so grateful for her existence. But in that frame of mind, I thought to myself that I was a burden to her. But actually what I didn't realize was that if I had left the world, especially in the way that I was planning to, that I would burden her even more, because she would feel like all those hardships that she overcame, everything that she sacrificed was for nothing. And, you know, as that clarity came to me, I said, I need to do something about the way I'm living. Like, I get it, positivity helps. And I've seen it make changes for me, whether it's at university or in my relationships or just in terms of career. But it wasn't organic for the most part. I felt like, you know, I didn't truly love myself and I didn't understand what it meant to love myself. And at that point, I made a promise to myself that I was going to find a more organic way of sustaining peace, joy and happiness. And when I do that, I might potentially share it with the world. But, you know, it was this journey that there was no expectations. There was just a promise to myself that I would do better for myself. And, you know, ever since, and I'm not going to say that I'm, you know, completely healed, because what does that even mean? I think like healing is non-linear and it's this journey that we're always on. Yeah, I realize that self-love ebbs and flows throughout life, the same with happiness. And I think I wanted a more organic journey of self-love. And since then, I've released 3 books. I've shared my messages with the world, you know, through the internet mostly, because it lets us reach people all over. And my messages seem to have resonated with a lot of people. And I'm very fortunate and grateful that I can share these messages with people and support them on their journeys. I like to look back on my life, and although there was a lot of pain, and at the time the pain didn't feel good, I see it as this catalyst for growth. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for those experiences in my life. And it's just been one incredible, incredible journey. The funny thing is actually that I forgot to mention earlier was that when I was a child, and I can't remember the specific age, it would have been between the ages of 5 and 8, I did ponder on this idea of writing a book one day. And I said to myself that I will overcome all of this that I'm going through, you know, the poverty, the hardship, even the racism, like all of these challenges, will overcome them one day, and I will write about them and show people exactly what I did to overcome these things. And when I look at my life now, I'm almost doing that. So it's almost like it's manifested this young boy's dream to overcome all the challenges in his life to then finally share it with the world. So I'm very grateful for that.
There's so much that I want to unpack in that story. The first thing, which your story and my story are absolutely completely different, but there are a lot of similarities in it. And one being this dark night of the soul where you have this epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the same thought, like I was looking out the window, I was like, life is not supposed to be like this. You have mm-hmm. a knowing that this is not right. And you know that it's only you that's able to change that, no one else. That you need to do the inner work to be able to make the change to have the better life. And like I said, I had that exact moment. It's like crystal clear, even though it was so many years ago. And I also picked up a book. I was like, I need to get into personal development work. I don't know why, I just have this feeling that this is going to lead me in the right direction. And I read some book that Louise Hay, I can't even remember the name, but it's like one of her most famous books. And then I started really getting into Abraham Hicks and the Law of Attraction. And I just was like, wow, this is unbelievable. But I think the thing that both you did and I do, which I teach to people, is the most important part of getting into personal development work is you can't just read it and understand it. You need to embody what you're reading and you're learning about. And a lot of people that I coach, it's a similar thing that they'll be like, oh, you know, I've seen this person and that person, but I haven't really done the work. I get what they're telling me, my psychologist or whoever it is they've dealt with, but I just don't have time to do the practices, or they don't do anything about what they understand, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
To want change in your life, you need to change. You can't be the same person thinking that your whole life's going to change. Like, you need to make the changes. And as you said, and as I experienced, once you actually do that and embody it completely, you'll see things shifting around you at a very fast pace. Like, that's what I experienced. And it's almost like the universe gives you breadcrumbs to show you you're on the right direction. And that's what gives you the fuel to keep on going and keep on going. And you just surprise yourself. But, like, you know, similar to you, it's never perfect. We then go through complete hardships and you think, oh my God, woe is me. And then again, something else will happen and it's amazing again. And you bounce back from that hardship a lot faster than what you would have. So I just think your story is such an incredible example of all of that.
So Sarah, I think what you said is absolutely true. And I think the book you were referring to was You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay.
That was it.
An absolutely amazing book. And the book's by Abraham Hicks. So I've read probably, I wouldn't say every Law of Attraction book out there, but I've read a lot of Law of Attraction books, from like your Neville Goddard to even, you know, books like The Secret, which I'm a little bit more commercial. I've read so many books, and I've been guilty of this, and I think a lot of people are guilty of this, is that we look for the next book to provide the next secret. Mm. And what we do is intellectually thirsty. So we want to consume as much knowledge as we can, knowing we need to do certain things. But instead of doing those certain things, we continue to just hoard all this information and we collect it and we're like, right, yeah, as soon I'll be ready. I just need to read one more book, maybe this book. Sometimes what happens also is that you'll read a book, you'll feel really inspired, really motivated, you take action, then life hits you with circumstances. Again, it could be challenges or obstacles, or it might just be that you're not seeing progress in that particular moment. In that particular moment, then you start to doubt everything that you've learned, everything that you've gone through. You think, well, actually, this doesn't work. This isn't actually working for me right now because I've hit a plateau, or I'm not seeing the results that I was seeing before. So I need to consume something new. So you move on to the next book or the next course. And although I think it's great to expose yourself to new information and new perspective, because we're on this constant journey of learning, we also have to realize that we have to apply that particular knowledge. Knowledge is only potential. It's not power. Knowledge applied becomes power. And I think a lot of the time when we sit on this knowledge, we're just sitting on potential to create changes in our life. It's not until we actually take action on that particular knowledge that we've consumed that can we realize its true power. I also feel like a lot of the time, and I was guilty of this as well, is that I read something, I understand it, I think, wow, this is so true. And then I go and teach it to other people. Now, that's a good way for me to learn it on an unconscious level. I think the most valuable wisdom is experiential wisdom. That's true wisdom to me. When you learn something and you teach it to other people and you tell other people what to do, it's the same as trying, it's the same as reading about a certain wine. And, you know, you read about the notes in the wine and you're like, wow, this is what the wine's like. And then you teach other people what the wine tastes like. You will only have knowledge to a certain degree of what the wine tastes like. And unless you've actually tasted the wine yourself, you will never know or grasp this full taste of that wine. And that's why I think it's so important to take information and try to apply it straight away. And also to realize that you have to give things time.
Yes.
Like, life is never going to be perfect. I experienced severe challenges as a child, but I also experience challenges now. Now, the challenges might look different. When I was younger, the challenges were mainly around security or a lack of acceptance in the society or community that I was raised in. And now they might be like, well, do I really want to do that particular project? Does it align with my values? Or it might be, you know, I'm hungry and me and my wife can't decide on what to have for dinner. Like, it might, you know, the magnitude of those challenges might not be the same, but we're always going to face challenges. We're always going to face obstacles. That's consistent throughout life. The knowledge and wisdom that you pick up from the books that you then apply are always going to be applicable. But yeah, you're absolutely right that I think a lot of the time we consume knowledge, but we don't go ahead and take action on that knowledge. And I'm so glad that I was able to do that eventually. But I also relate to a lot of people that just consume and don't do anything with it.
even listening to us today, it's like we can give you the keys to the door, but you need to walk through that door.
Exactly.
I think that's so unbelievably powerful. And, you know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about is when you were reading Napoleon Hill's book, what was it in there that inspired you and what kind of shifts did you start making in your life?
I think with every book that I read and every success story that I came across, so I read Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich, and it instilled hope that there was something better out there for me, that by changing my mindset, I could change my response to the circumstances that I was dealt with. So I can't necessarily change the cards that I'm dealt with, but I can change the way I view those cards, and I can change the way, actually, I think it's Joseph Murphy in his book, The Power of Subconscious Mind. He said that you can't change the wind, but you can adjust the sails. It reframes your way of thinking. And it, you know, I was in a certain circumstance that I wasn't happy with, that wasn't favorable, but that doesn't mean that I can't change how I respond to circumstances to create a new outcome. There's that idea of a ship taking off, and if it went straight, it would land at a particular destination. But if it changed slightly, just one degree that way, it could end up in a completely different country. Mm. And I think that presents a very important idea that small changes can lead to big results. Mm. And those changes can literally just be your responses to the things that you're witnessing in your life.
That is so true. And I want to give this example because it's something that is so little and really not a big deal. When I learned exactly that, I kind of really reflected and thought, I remember having my daughter at the time, I think it was like her second or third birthday. And I remember thinking, like, I'd always get really stressed before her parties. And I thought, why? But why am I stressed before her parties? It was just this program I'd go into of being really stressed out for no reason. And I thought, maybe I just won't get stressed out this year, whatever. Like, I just looked at the situation so differently. And then we had her party and it was great. And I thought, I could do that with everything in life. Like, I could change the way I look at everything in life. Why have I looked at life as being things being such a big deal when they're not a big deal? It was like something so minor was this pinnacle moment. I don't know why I looked at it like that. It's like a program. Maybe learn it from your parents or God knows what.
Yeah, it's this script that just continues to run unless you change the program or change the script. And it's so funny that a lot of the times we have fear of the unknown where we could trust the unknown. Both of you are asking to believe in the unseen, things that haven't happened yet. But, you know, fear almost disempowers you, whereas faith empowers you. So why would you not choose the latter, something that's going to help you feel good and also empower your mind? When I was reading Napoleon Hill's book, I then decided to read a lot more books, and I was really into sports. So I'm a massive sports fan, and I decided to study some of the greatest athletes in the world and just look at their lives and see what they've gone through. I then started to look at people like Albert Einstein and, you know, Martin Luther King and other iconic individuals. And I realized that there were so many people who had faced so many hardships, but had still created amazing lives for themselves. And I used to be obsessed with reading. So there used to be a print that used to come out every year of, you know, the rich list. And I know this sounds very materialistic, but for someone that was going through poverty at the time, I thought money was the solution to all of my problems. So I used to be obsessed with looking at the rich list. And I remember one year the rich list was printed and three people in the top 10 were orphans or had been orphans.
Really?
And I thought to myself, wow, there's three people here who are amongst the wealthiest people in the world, who have subjectively had worse childhoods than me, but have yet created amazing lives for themselves, at least financially. If they can do it, then why can I not do it? And that question really, I think, changed everything for me. It was knowing that there were people who had gone through deep suffering, deep pain, who had overcome incredibly challenging times, but had then gone on to do marvelous things. And the only thing that got them from point A to B was their mindset. And that's when I realized that I needed to change the way I looked at my life. I needed to change the way I respond to life. I needed to change the fact that I think I'm a victim here. Yes, in some circumstances, I am a victim. I'm a victim to violence, for example. If I'm, you know, getting beaten up by a group of 10 people, I am a victim in that particular circumstance, but I'm not going to let that define me. Because if I continue to tell myself I'm a victim, life is always going to treat me like a victim. So I switched from this victim mentality to the victor, where I was like, okay, I'm going to be a winner. The only problem is that I did it in a slightly unhealthy way, which then caught up with me in my early 20s.
What did you do?
Well, at the time when I said I wanted to escape my life and I managed to stay around, and I said to myself, you know, I'm never going to go back to that point. I just said to myself, you know, do I even love myself? Like, what does that even mean? I think nowadays self-love is thrown around on the internet and people, you know, say stuff like, you know, you need to go and take yourself on a date. That's self-love. Or, you know, you need to know your worth and can't have a man or woman like this. That's self-love. And there's all these ideas of self-love. And I thought, well, they sound great, you know, and a lot of the time they're morale boosting, they can boost your ego, they can be comforting. But is that a practical way of looking at self-love? Because I knew that there were inner demons that I needed to face. There was this unhealthy conditioning that I needed to let go of. There were these scripts that I was running on that weren't healthy. There were these unconscious beliefs that I needed to rewrite. Addressing those things, to me, were self-love as well. Because self-love is also wanting better for yourself. It's not just about accepting yourself as you are. It's also accepting that there are things that you need to change about yourself because you deserve better, because the world deserves better of you. So over the years, I've changed my definition of self-love quite a lot. But I think the most consistent definition of self-love to me is doing what's necessary. And I say necessary rather than desirable, because what's desired isn't always what's necessary. What's desired will leave you in your comfort zone, but what's necessary might ask you to step out of your comfort zone so you can return to your wholeness. So I'll say that once more, that self-love is doing what's necessary to return to a state of wholeness. And that can look like all kinds of things. It could be, for some people, it might just be hugging a tree so they feel connected to themselves and to the universe. It could be going to therapy. It could be journaling. It could be running a hot bath because you're so stressed. You're burnt out. And by having that hot bath, you return back home to your heart, to yourself, and you get this sense of wholeness. So self-love can look different, but it can also be going to the gym, which isn't always, you know, people that hate the gym might say, well, I don't like going to the gym, but it could be any form of exercise. It doesn't always feel comfortable at the time, but it can help you return to this sense of wholeness. Mm. So I just, you know, went on this journey of self-love, and I was, rather than trying to shut my emotions down, I did it, you know, I did it with great acceptance. I felt everything that came up, every story that emerged, every experience, even if they were traumatic, every experience that came up, I acknowledged it, and I, you know, did my best to let it go. And sometimes that meant that I had to let these stories, this conditioning and this pain go multiple times. And even to this day, you know, I wouldn't say I'm fully healed as such, but I'm on this journey and, you know, I'm better for it.
I kind of want to talk about the hope piece because I think that is just so pertinent. And I actually interviewed a guy recently who was falsely put in prison for 29 years. And he was saying that like hope was the thing that got him through. If he didn't have hope, he didn't have anything. And I think people think it's a bit wishy-washy hope, but I don't believe that to be true because like you said, why not believe in something better happening? I mean, who doesn't want an existence that is like that, rather than thinking like it's all doom and gloom the whole time. And I'm a true believer of, if you do change the way you look at things, those things around you start changing, because I've experienced it for myself. It's actually incredible. Your suffering comes from your interpretation of the world. Mm-hmm. People can say things to you that are really negative, but the way that you interpret those, or the way that you let them in to affect you, is what's hurting you, not what they're actually saying or doing. So this mindset piece gets thrown around a lot. I mean, the mind is everything, really.
It is. It is. And I like how you brought up hope there, because if you think about the way we view the present and the future, we're actually looking at it through the lens of the past. And the lens of the past, a lot of the time, people look back on their experiences that haven't gone to plan to then view their present and future. Mm. So when we talk about having fear in what might come, we look back on the past and we look at all the times things haven't gone to plan. And then we assume that the future is set for gloom. But there are so many occasions that things have gone to plan. And I suppose it's this negativity bias that we have, is that it's the same way as, say, you're on social media and you make an incredible post and it resonates with so many people, and then you get the one person that says, this is rubbish, or you don't know what you're talking about, and you hang on to that one negative comment, right? It's the negativity bias that we have in our minds. It's so much easier to hold on to that piece of negativity rather than remember all the positivity that was shared. And we do that when we view the future as well, is we look back, we look at all the things that went wrong, and we assume that the future is going to go wrong too. Whereas we could easily seek out, and sometimes this requires a more conscious effort, we could seek out the times and experiences that served us, that went well, and we can look at the future and the present through that lens, because both are true. So it's not about it being wishy-washy, and it's not even about it being delusional. It's about finding the evidence in the past and then using that to support how you view the present and the future. And everyone can do that. Even me as a child who was going through this homelessness and poverty and violence, there were moments filled with joy. There were moments where things did go well, things did go right. Right now, I'm just highlighting the things that didn't. But there were plenty of moments that did go right, did go well, that did work out. And I could use those to build the hope up for the future. And that's exactly what I did.
I wanted to talk to you, you know, firstly, you've got this amazing book. We haven't even brought it up. It's called Closer to Love, where a lot of what we're talking about is in there. You talk about when we're meeting people, like, you know, you're going through a change. You might have got into personal development work, and then suddenly you're, I find the word funny, but like vibrating on a different level to the people that you may have been friendly with earlier on in life. And you realize that you're kind of moving further and further apart, but it can be very heartbreaking. And you talk a bit about this in your book. So I'd like to speak about it, because it seems to be a very common theme with a lot of people who send me emails and message me.
Yeah. So as you desire better for yourself, and as you step into your growth, you're naturally going to outgrow people that were resonating with the old version of you. And the old version of you included certain belief systems, certain ways of viewing life, so certain perspectives and perceptions, and a certain underlying energy that we might call vibration. When things don't align, you will naturally feel this kind of misalignment, a sense of friction. You realize that you aren't on the same path as those other people anymore. And a lot of the time, I think we hang on to those people because of this shared history that we might have. So as I desired better for myself, there were people that I realized were limiting me in what I could do, where I could go. And I realized that the longer I kept them around, the more friction it caused, because now I was almost stepping into a new version of me, whereas they were comfortable with hanging on to the old version of them and the way we lead the world together. And I think it's a very hard decision, because at that point, sometimes you feel a little bit of guilt. You think, actually, we've known each other for so long. I almost feel guilty for moving on with my life. But at the same time, you realize that it's almost costing you your future to keep people around that constantly interfere with this new sense of optimism and hope and direction, because they're still clinging to their old belief systems. And I think the only thing you can really do is you can accept those people for who they are, and you can take the things that they say and do non-personally. So you can say, right, that's how you view the world, and this is how I view the world. We're not resonating on the same frequency. That is that we're not energetically on the same level, and that's okay. I'm not going to let your energy affect mine. But the truth is that a lot of the time it does affect you, especially if you've only started stepping into a new direction. Because when you've just stepped into a new direction, it's very easy to be pulled back into the old direction. And I think a lot of the time what we need to do is we need to almost break away from those circumstances and people that were holding us back. And that can, I think, be one of the biggest challenges. But at the same time, I also believe that as you start maybe acquiring more natural and organic optimism, because some people are vibrationally incompatible with you, that is that their energy doesn't align with yours, that they will naturally gravitate away from you as well. So for example, if you're exuding all this optimism and joy, people that aren't quite there yet might not really understand why you're so positive, why you're so optimistic. And that will pee them off.
Yeah, to repel
quite bluntly a lot of the time.
Yeah,
and it repels. So sometimes it will push people away. And I also believe that sometimes, you know, those people might go, you know, everyone's going through their own journey. So they might go through their own journey and then start seeing life in maybe the same way as you. And eventually they might catch up to the same kind of space as well. And that's why I think it's so important to, when you're working on yourself and you know you're doing the work, is to accept how your relationships unfold. Because if you're on this path to loving yourself, if you're on this path to doing the work, if you're on this path of evolution and growth, then the things that you're experiencing are aligned to your greatest version of reality. So why would then you try to invite people back or force people to be on the journey when they're misaligned?
I totally agree with you. And, you know, I've seen it happen in my own life. It can be very hard. Like, even like we said, when we know all of this information, it can be really still hard to move away from people when they've been in our life for a long period of time, or, you know, see them move away from us as well. And I'm a true believer that you'll then attract these new people that are on the same wavelength as you. I've again seen it happen. When you're going through it, it can be quite painful.
So, Sarah, I think you brought up a very interesting point, and I speak about this in my latest book, Closer to Love, is that when we part ways with someone, we go through a grieving process, but a lot of the times we don't acknowledge that grieving process because we think that a relationship breakup of such is just, you know, it's just us moving on and everything will be okay. But I actually compare it to bereavement, not to the same intensity, but if you think about when COVID came about, there was a lot of, and you know, there were the pandemic restrictions, there was a lot of sadness that was within communities and societies. And a lot of the sadness was because people were expecting reality to be a certain way. They were looking forward to certain things. For example, it could have been a gig that you were planning to go to in summer, or holiday you had planned with your family. And suddenly that was taken away from you. Those hopes and dreams were pulled away from you. In the same way, when we lose a friendship, a family tie, and a romantic relationship, all those hopes and dreams, that future that you had planned out with that person, is taking away from you. It's a type of loss. So in Closer to Love, I talk about when you lose someone, you go through four particular stages. So it's shock and numbness, yearning and searching, disorganization and despair, and reorganization and repair. And I feel like those stages actually occur when we lose relationships. So the shock and numbness is just this coping strategy. You're shocked by what's happened. You feel a little bit numb. I think everyone can resonate with that to some degree, especially when you're going through a heartbreak. And then the yearning and searching is sometimes you wish things will restore back to how they were. So sometimes we want our partner back if we've lost a partner, a romantic partner. We want things to be how they were. You sometimes want the other person to return to your life. The disorganization and despair is reality almost sinks in. Now you have to live your life without that person in your life. And sometimes, especially when it's heartbreak, is we can withdraw from our daily interactions and just our daily life because we're so saddened by what we're experiencing. And then the reorganization and repair is really about hope and optimism. So you look back on your relationship with that person with more positive memories. Now, it doesn't mean that you might not stop mourning, their loss, but it just means that you're more accepting of the new reality that you're facing. And I think that those phases are very applicable when we lose people, even if it is us choosing to part ways with someone that we no longer resonate with, because it is hard. We've built these connections over so many years, and to then not have that person around, we do go through a process of loss. So it's okay to feel the pain and the sadness that comes across. I think you can move on from someone and still feel, for the right reasons, shall I say, and still feel deep sadness and regret. It's just a part of being human.
Absolutely. You coach a lot of NBA players, not in basketball, but in mindset. And I'd love to know, you spoke about the wealth thing being a big deal to you when you were young because you didn't have much. But now working with them and seeing how much they have, what has that taught you about the correlation between money and happiness?
Such a great question. I've worked with... I've worked with so many different people that I always dreamt of working with when I was younger, and it almost feels like surreal at times. So there's the NBA basketball players, professional soccer or football players, Olympians, gold medalists, swimmers, music artists, all kinds of people. And sometimes I'd even question why someone of that, someone with that status would come to little old me for advice or to help them with their life. And I'm like, well, you seem to have everything. You've got, the happy marriage, the Lamborghini, the big house, like everything that I thought would give me happiness as a child. Yet here you are, unhappy or not content with your life because of the things that you're going through externally or internally within your mind. And I think there's this fallacy, so it's called the arrival fallacy, and it's that when we arrive to a certain destination, we're going to sustain happiness. When I get the house, when I get the child or the partner, when I make X amount of money, I'm going to be happy. But I think one thing that's consistent is change. Change is actually, it's the only consistent in life. And the thing is, when you arrive at a certain location or destination, that happiness from getting that object of desire is going to last for a very short amount of time until you desire change again, until you want the next thing. You get the iPhone 10, you want the 11. When you get the 11, you want the 12. And if you don't have that thing, not having that particular thing brings about a state of suffering. What I've learned over the years is that although money can give me security and money will eradicate a lot of problems that are tied with money, there's a lot of problems in life that exist completely independent of money, of luxury, of whatever it is. There's always the challenges, for example, that are going on within your mind. And if you're not at peace within your mind, it doesn't matter what you do externally, you will never hang on to happiness. So actually for me and for all the people that I work with is that the realization is that happiness actually only comes from two real things. It's accepting each moment as it is and finding gratitude within that moment. And why gratitude is so powerful. And, you know, if we think about it in terms of the law of attraction, that the things, if you're grateful for the things that you have in your life, life will give you more things to be grateful for. And that's a very simple premise of the law of attraction. And I completely agree with that. But actually what gratitude does in terms of happiness is very powerful. Gratitude assumes that the reality that you have is to your expectation or is better than your expectations. Suffering arises when reality doesn't meet your expectations. So gratitude is actually the antidote to that, because it's telling you that life is okay, is great as it is. And here's the paradox, is that when you start accepting your life as it is and you set an intention, you're more likely to manifest that intention, because now you're in a state of total surrender. There is no doubt. Doubt and fear creates resistance to your goals. So once you start actually having gratitude and you start finding joy in the present moment, you vibrate higher. And as you vibrate higher, you meet circumstances that align with that higher vibration.
It's so true. Recently, it was actually only yesterday. I had these two things that I really, really wanted, and they were big things. And I wasn't like holding on to them. It was like two things that I just put out and I was like, I really want this to happen. And I found a sense of that, knowing that they would come into my life. Within 24 hours yesterday, both of them came to be. You know, I teach people manifestation, but I am still blown away by manifestation. It was incredible. And the way that you get it delivered in circumstances you'll never imagine for yourself. And I just lay, after my meditation, I lay on the ground and I put my hands on my heart and I was like, I am so grateful right now. And there was such a sense of love that was within me. And I agree with you. I think practicing gratitude, and even if it's like just you're in your car in the middle of the day and you just go into that kind of heart-centered feeling, it's such a powerful emotion, and it is the fastest way to happiness, to be grateful for what we have around us. And there is always something to be grateful for.
I think people really struggle with gratitude sometimes because they look at their life and they're like, there's nothing for me to be grateful for. And that's because the state of being that they're in is clouded by uncertainty, doubt, and fear. When I was younger and I was experiencing the homelessness, and if someone said to me, you know, be grateful for your life, you know, I'd probably, at the time at least, not anymore because I'm in a much greater place than then, but at the time I probably would have wanted to punch them in the face, because I'd have been like, well, what can I be grateful for? I'm homeless. My mum's got no money. But I had a very loving and supportive family. So the way I tell people to approach gratitude sometimes is, and we said this actually earlier, just before we started recording, was that sometimes absence helps you bring about presence. And you can think of something that you have in your life and then imagine your life without that particular thing. And that can then make you very thankful for having that particular object in your life.
That's so true.
Having my family there got me through those challenging and easing moments. And if I didn't have them there, I don't know how I would have got through those moments. You know, maybe at the time I wouldn't have been able to think in that particular way, but I do that a lot these days as well, is that, and you know, there is, for me, there's a lot to be thankful for. Even just putting a book out in the world, I'm very grateful for. But when you're clouded by certain heavy, dark emotions, it is hard to find gratitude. And sometimes I will just look around me. I'll look at my laptop and I think, wow, like if I didn't have my laptop here, I wouldn't be able to write a book. I wouldn't be able to communicate with you. I wouldn't be able to sit on this podcast. So just imagining that particular thing and not having it in your life can really inspire gratitude.
Yeah, I love that. Vex, what is something that you wish for yourself?
That's such a deep and fantastic question. I honestly think one thing that I really want for myself, this might sound cliche, is to just love myself wholeheartedly, because I know that when I do that, I'm better able to serve people in the world. I'm better able to connect with people in the world, and my relationships transform into something so much more blissful, something much deeper, something, you know, beyond mind. And I'm on this journey of self-love. I've been on it for numerous years, and I know that self-love, you know, we mentioned it before, self-love ebbs and flows. So one thing I'd want for myself is to just continue to love myself at deeper levels and just continue that path. So I can show up in the world in a better way.
What's the best advice that you have ever been given?
I'm going to give you two pieces of advice, because there was a long period of my life where I wasn't really given advice as such. In fact, if I was given advice, it would be poor advice, and just accept your life as it is, which I don't think we necessarily should. I think there should be a state of acceptance to find happiness, but at the same time, we exist on this planet to make the world a better place. So there's a state of being and there's also a state of doing, and that needs to be balanced. But I think one of the pieces of advice was in Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich, is that whatever the mind can believe and conceive, it can achieve. And I truly believe that it all starts at the layer of mind. Everything you see around you has come from an idea or a thought or a belief. And that has really changed my entire life. The other piece of advice is actually from my wife. And, you know, I met her many years after this kind of personal development journey. And it's just to be yourself, because I think a lot of the time who we are is who we think we need to be accepted in the world. And I felt that very heavy-heartedly when I was younger, because I was rejected so much by the community that I was in because of the way I looked. And even to this day, you know, I'm in this personal development field and I'm very grateful that I've had great success with my books, but I just want to be myself. I just want to be me and hopefully inspire people to also be them and to find success in being in themselves rather than changing themselves to be something to then find success. So I think that piece of advice that my wife gave has really stuck with me throughout the years. And it's something that I continue to carry across my work, is that I can do all kinds of things to sell more books, to be, you know, bigger or whatever it is. But all those things they just feed the ego. I'm trying to serve from the heart. And to serve from the heart, I just need to be me. And I also want to show people that they can find success, love and happiness by being themselves too.
Do you have a favorite prayer, saying or mantra?
As simple as it sounds, I think something around letting go is very important to me. And I think something that I remind myself of regularly, and you could call it a mantra or a phrase, is that if you can't control or change the circumstances, then you just have to let it go, because we dwell on so much of the things that we can't control. Manifestation teaches us that we're co-creators, that we can shape reality in the way we desire. But there's so much of life that we can't change. And that is, for example, what is happening now in this moment. I'm in this particular room, for example, this table's in front of me. Now, if I want to change this table into, I don't know, an animal, I can't do that, right? It defies the law of, you know, science. But I think a lot of the times we stay stuck on things that we literally have no control over. Mm. And we overthink these particular things. We make ourselves more miserable. And as we overthink these things, we create more problems and challenges for ourselves. And suddenly, actually, it's counterproductive to what we want to do, which is find solutions and change our lives. So if you can't change a certain thing, let it go. And then focus on the things that you can change. And the two things usually are, there are things that you can change. It's changing your course of actions. And it could be changing your perception of whatever else is in front of you.
What is a life of greatness to you?
A life of greatness to me is living your life as the best version of yourself. And that to me is a journey. It's a journey of outdoing the person you were yesterday. It's about looking back on the day before and thinking, what did I do well and what came up short? And then taking that thing that you came up short on and working at that particular thing. I think if you can do that every single day, it's much easier said than done, that you will live a life of greatness, because you then will work towards the greatest version of yourself. If you want to live a life of greatness, you have to become the greatest version of yourself.
Beautiful. Vex King, thank you so much for all the work that you have put into the world. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. Listener.